We found last week that Paul is teaching Titus to teach the older women three things. He said, train them to be, number one, godly in their demeanor, reverent. Number two, to be in control of their tongue, to be in mastery over what's in their heart, because that's what comes out through your mouth. And then number three, to be in control of the flesh, not addicted to wine or addicted to anything else for that matter. If you are reverent, God-fearing in your demeanor, and you have control over what comes out of your mouth, and you are in command of the appetites of your flesh, then you are qualified to teach what is good, to be a teacher of what is good. Only a virtuous person is qualified to teach virtue. And that's where we left off last time, but I want to make you understand that it's not that you have to be perfect. You understand that? Everyone has failed in these areas in the past. If your past were a disqualifier, if you've ever done anything wrong in your past, then nobody would be qualified. The issue is not the sins you've committed in the past. The issue is what your heart is like right now. If you've ever really blown it in one of these areas in the past, you can serve now as a godly example of a woman who can recover from spiritual failure. And that is an example that the young women are desperately in need of. So many people have a serious failure or a string of failures over a period of time and they just give up. They've had such trouble trying to overcome a sin, or they've failed so many times, they get depressed, they obsess about their failure, and they just give up. They say, I can't do this, I'll never be a godly woman, and so on. And so people like that need to see your example that you failed and you got back up. Proverbs 24:16. Though a righteous man falls seven times, he rises again, but the wicked are brought down by calamity. That's a verse that's talking about calamity, not specifically about sin, but it applies to the calamity of sin. You're brought down. A righteous man, a righteous woman might fall again and again and again and again. The number seven represents completeness, but she keeps getting up. The wicked come to a point where they're just brought down and they stay down for good. So if you failed, don't let that discourage you. Just have a godly response now. Then you can train the younger women. Now let's look at verse 4. We had some discussion over this last Sunday night over whose responsibility this is to initiate this teaching. Should the young women come and seek out the older women, ask for advice, or should the older women grab the younger women, sit them down, and teach them? And let me say a couple things about that. First of all, those of you who are younger women, you can't expect the older women to just walk up to you out of the blue and say, here, let me give you a lesson, and start teaching it. You know, I mean, that's not practical. You need to seek out their advice. They don't know what you need. They know a lot of things, but they don't know what's on your mind, what's going on in your life, what's on your heart, and what you need. You need to ask. But older women, those of you who are older and have something to offer, you need to understand that there's a lot of things that you can only teach the younger women if you know them, if you have some kind of a relationship, some kind of a friendship. Now, who's going to initiate that? You, if you're the one who's more mature, are the more likely candidate to approach a younger woman to establish a relationship. Most younger women are desperate for close friendships. They really long for that, and yet it doesn't occur to them to seek that in an older woman. They always think that it has to be someone their own age, somebody with their same age kids and all that. But it doesn't. You know, the last church we were in, Tracy's best friend, her closest friend, was a woman in her 80s, and that was just an amazing friendship in both directions. Really profited both women. Very often when people get old, they don't think they have much to offer because of physical limitations, and yet sometimes the older people are people who make the best friends. And I've had elderly people tell me that it means a lot to them when a younger person will take an interest in them because for that very reason. So, should it be the younger women who initiate this or the older women who initiate it? Whose responsibility is it? How about this? Yours. Yours. I mean, regardless of who the logical candidate is to initiate it, you don't have any control over anyone else. You only have control over yourself, so why don't you do it? Why don't you initiate it? All right, so let's talk about what it is exactly, the content that the older women are to teach the younger women. First, I want to give you a little bit of cultural context, and actually a lot of cultural context, because you need to have some background to be able to appreciate this. There's some things that... At first, this passage sounds like a kind of a problem passage to a lot of women. It talks about being submissive to your husband and love your husband and be devoted to your kids and work at home and all that. People struggle with that. A lot of women kind of struggle. I want to show you some background that's going to help you really appreciate this. When I get done with this background, hopefully I'll be able to read this passage, and instead of it sounding like a troublesome passage, it'll sound like music to your ears. I want to start by talking about the strategic place of the family in God's program. Very, very high on Satan's list, priority list, is the destruction of the family. And there's an important reason for that. God has promised to bless the family. God has promised to bless two institutions, just two, the church and the family. Now, there's a lot of great organizations, millions of wonderful organizations, parachurch groups, Bible studies, missions groups, youth groups, men's groups, women's groups, recovery groups, whatever. But there are only two organizations that God has promised to bless, and it's the church and the family. And since those two organizations are the means by which God has decided to be, to things that God has used as conduits to bring his grace into this world, Satan, you can bet, has as his number one priority the destruction of those two institutions. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see it. You don't have to be some kind of social expert to see the onslaught being brought on the family in our culture. If God has chosen the family to be the means by which godliness is passed on from generation to generation, Satan knows that if he can just dismantle the family, he can inflict long-term damage. Dragging people into sin one by one is just too slow. If he could shut off the proliferation of a godly heritage from generation to generation and prevent millions of people in future generations from even being exposed to godliness in the first place and growing up in a godly home, that's going to be far more effective. And so the attack is on, and it is on full blast. It is not subtle. Sometimes Satan is subtle, sometimes he's not. There's nothing subtle about this movement in our culture. And probably the most devastating element of it has come from the feminist movement. Now, right there, I don't know if some hackles go up in here. I realize there are millions of women who consider themselves feminist just because they're for equal pay for equal work and respectful treatment of women and fairness in the workplace and dignity and all that. If you're for those things, then that's fine. And there's nothing wrong with those things. Those are good things. But if that's what you're for, don't, because of that, attach yourself to a godless, wicked, satanic movement like feminism. And that's not an overstatement. Things like respectful treatment of women or fairness are not what the women of the feminists, the leaders of the feminist movement are after. What they are after is nothing less than the complete destruction of the family and the abolition of godly roles of men and women altogether. God-ordained roles are repulsive to them, and they want to wipe them out. It is not just a group of ladies who are tired of doing household chores and want to get out for a little freedom and dignity. It is an all-out attack on the family and ultimately an all-out attack on God himself. And if you, that's not just my assessment. This is what they say. And if you doubt that, let me give you a few quotes. Regarding their view of marriage, Betty Friedan, who is the founder of the National Organization of Women, wrote this, quote, she wrote The Feminine Mystique, and in that book she said the traditional family is a, quote, comfortable concentration camp from which women need to be liberated. That book propagates the idea that if a woman chooses to be a housewife, that is a pathology rather than a choice that a healthy woman could just make. You want to be a housewife, you have a mental instability in your brain somewhere. Sheila Cronin, one of the feminist movement's most respected leaders and spokeswomen, said, since marriage constitutes slavery for women, it is clear that the women's movement must concentrate on attacking this institution. Freedom for women cannot be won without the abolition of marriage. Robin Morgan said, we cannot destroy the inequities of between men and women until we destroy marriage, end quote. You see, it's not subtle. The November 1971 Declaration of Feminism says this, quote, marriage has existed for the benefit of men and has been largely sanctioned method of control over women. We must work to destroy it. Marriage. The end of the institution of marriage is a necessary condition for the liberation of women. Therefore, it is important for us to encourage women to leave their husbands and not live individually with men. All of history must be rewritten in terms of oppression of women. And we must go back to the ancient female religions like witchcraft. Now, we'll get back to that in a minute. But that gives you an idea of their view of marriage. Their view of children isn't much different. Margaret Sanger, who's the founder of Planned Parenthood, said, quote, the most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it. The most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it. Molly Yard said, quote, I consider the Chinese government's forced abortion policy among the most intelligent in the world. And Mary Jo Bain, who's assistant professor of education at Wellesley College, said, quote, "In order to raise children with equality, we must take them away from families and communally raise them." If that reminds you at all of Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child, that's not any surprise. That's where she went to college. That's her agenda. Here's how the feminists, if you want to know how the feminists would have you think about your own children, ladies, here you listen to Andrea Dworkin. Quote, "Every woman's son is her potential betrayer and also the inevitable rapist or exploiter of another woman." She goes on, "For a woman, the home is the most dangerous place in the world. The traditional flowers of courtship are the traditional flowers of the grave, delivered to the victim before the kill. The cadaver is dressed up and made up and laid down and ritually violated and consecrated to an eternity of being used. I want to see a man beaten to a bloody pulp with a high heel shoved in his mouth like an apple in the mouth of a pig." Which brings us to their thoughts about men, which are not very subtle either. This is not something that they're apologetic about. They don't say things like that and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm slip of the tongue, I didn't mean that." Robin Morgan, who is an editor of Ms. Magazine, said, quote, "I feel that man-hating is an honorable and viable political act and that the oppressed have a right to class hatred against the class that is oppressing them." Marilyn French was an advisor to Al Gore's presidential campaign. She said, "All men are rapists, and that's all they are. All men." And the reason they say things like that is because these women believe that all intercourse that involves a man is rape, period. Doesn't matter if it's consensual or non-consensual, married, doesn't matter. And that's a major part of their goal. The National Organization of Women has always had as its goal converting as many women as possible to lesbianism. And they're very active about that. That's why you read things like this in the Now Times. Quote, "The simple fact is that every woman must be willing to be identified as a lesbian to be fully feminist." That's their agenda. Shulmaya Firestone said, quote, "The incest taboo can be destroyed only by destroying the nuclear family." Isn't that amazing? She just assumes that, of course, we need to get rid of this taboo against incest. And then she goes on to say the only way we're going to do it is to get rid of the nuclear family. She just assumes, you know, that's a bad thing. "The only way we're going to get rid of the taboo of incest is by destroying the nuclear family as a primary institution of the culture. The nuclear family is the school of values in a sexist, sexually repressed society. The alternative to a nuclear family at the moment is the extended family or the tribe. The growth of the tribe is part of the process of destroying particularized roles and fixed erotic identity." What she's saying there is, we got to get rid of this concept of fixed erotic identity. You got a concept that you're a male and you go with a female, or you're a female, you go with a male. That is, and it's fixed. It's the same as today as it was yesterday. You got to get rid of that. The whole male and female role thing has to go. And the only way to get rid of that is to get rid of the nuclear family, because that's where those values are passed on. She's right about that. And so the attack specifically on the biblical roles for men and women is fierce. I mean fierce. They hate anything that has to do with biblical role for a woman. Vivian Gornick, who's a feminist author, says this, quote, "Being a housewife is an illegitimate profession. The choice to serve and be protected and plan towards being a family maker is a choice that shouldn't be. And the heart of radical feminism is to change that," end quote. You ever wonder, why do they care? What does she care? Why does Vivian Gornick care? If she wants to go off and do whatever her thing is, fine, but why is she so worked up about you wanting to be a housewife? Why does that matter so much to her? They claim that they're all about freedom. They're all about choices for women. And yet, they'll heap such scorn on a woman that makes a choice to be a mother or a homemaker. Why? If they're really just about civil treatment of women and they want to, and they just want women to be treated well, why are they so violently against something like Promise Keepers, for example, which promotes those very things? The reason is because that's not what they're all about. What they're all about is promoting the agenda of their founder, which is Satan. And wittingly or unwittingly, that's what they're about. They hate God. And the thing that you need to understand is the roots of modern feminism go back to ancient Gnosticism, a religion known as Gnosticism, which was a feminist religion that glorified women. And I don't want to get into too many details about Gnosticism, but you probably already have heard that Gnosticism taught that matter is evil. Stuff, physical stuff, is evil, and spirit is good. What you may not have known is the reason they say matter is evil is because matter is male and spirit is female, and that's the reason spirit is good. In fact, they taught that if you read ancient, just pick up some ancient Gnostic teaching and read it, it's amazing the things that they say. They taught that Eve and the serpent were heroes who rescued the man from the evil god Yahweh, the male god Yahweh, whom they taught was a stupid, bungling, sub-god demiurge who, in his stupidity, created matter. And the true Christ, who is feminine, was in the serpent in the garden. The physical Jesus was male, and he was a joke, and the true Christ laughed at the physical Jesus as he hung on the cross. You see, at the very heart of the feminist movement is that kind of paganism that has just a violent, deep-seated hatred for God, the God of the Bible, and for Christ and the cross. And those ancient Gnostic beliefs are repeated almost verbatim in the rhetoric of modern-day feminism. It's not dead. Gloria Steinem, editor of Ms. Magazine, says, by the end of the year 2000, we will raise our children to believe in human potential, not God. And Annie Laurie Gaylor said, quote, let's forget about the mythical Jesus and look for encouragement, solace, and inspiration from real women. 2,000 years of patriarchal rule under the shadow of the cross ought to be enough to turn women toward the feminist salvation of this world. Pretty clear message, isn't it? You say, well, that's the world. No, that's in the church. You won't believe how much that's infiltrating the church. The church, which is all but lost its will to use discernment altogether, has begun to embrace this all the way down to its pagan roots. Unless you think Gnosticism is just some ancient religion that died out hundreds of years ago, let me remind you about the re-imaging conference of 1993. I don't know if you remember that, but I remember it vividly because I was in a Methodist church at the time, which means some of my offering money was going to support this thing. It was a conference where 1,700 women came together for a Christian conference sponsored by the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Methodist Church, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, and some other mainline denominations, and they worshipped the goddess Sophia, whom they called our maker Sophia. They had a mock communion ritual called milk and honey, calling for Sophia's aid in replacing traditional Christianity, and homosexuality was openly and enthusiastically affirmed. One of the speakers, Dr. Dolores Williams of Union Theological Seminary, shouted this, we don't need to hear about somebody hanging on a cross and blood dripping and all that stuff. And when she said that, the whole place erupted in applause. They despised Christ, they despised the cross. This is a Christian conference. At another conference, the women chanted this, quote, the earth is a woman. And she rises, and we all live in her. And that connection with the earth and the environmentalist movement, that's something that you also need to know. I know this sounds like a political thing here. I'm not concerned about the politics of this. I'm concerned about the satanic religion that's behind some of these things. And it's made its way into politics, but that's not the concern. There is a very close connection between the feminist movement and the environmentalist movement. In fact, and you can see it in Al Gore's book, Earth and the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. He talks in that book about his belief in the connectedness of all things and the great value of all religions, and his hope that ancient pagan goddess worship will help us bring planetary and personal salvation. He said, Christianity has all but abolished ancient pagan goddess worship, which is a shame. That's too bad, and we need to return to that in order to find salvation. At another Bible conference, a tenured professor at Boston College, who is also a lesbian and a witch, spoke and said, what is all this biblical bull blank? And was cheered by this crowd of seminarians and Bible scholars and ministers. That re-imaging conference, you would think that that thing would, you know, they'd do it and it would be a shock and they'd shut it down. They didn't. It became an annual event. And the speaker at the fourth one invited the audience of several hundred women, many of them ordained ministers, who were sitting at tables with apples that had been placed on the tables. And they said, you should take a bite of the apple. And all the women did that. And they said, let us bite into the apple in celebration, for we, like Eve, are created to know. It's just this rhetoric of the serpent. It's not even disguised. And that's right out of Gnosticism. The serpent was a good female influence rescuing everybody from the evil god who was male and was forbidding that fruit. They worshiped the serpent in the garden. That same conference featured a goddess wall where they had reproductions of 33 ancient and modern goddesses, which Christians could now adopt as their own personal concepts of deity. There's Christian women going to this conference and being exposed to this. If the church can't see how important the family is to God, Satan can, and that's why he's made such a concerted attack against the family and male and female roles nonstop from the Garden of Eden to September of 2003. And it's, you look anywhere in history and you'll see this movement going, the feminist movement, and it was going strong in Paul's day. And that's why you see so many times in the New Testament where he's emphasizing God's ordained roles for men and women. George Gilder is an interesting guy. He's not a Christian. He was a feminist writer and then became disillusioned with feminism and switched sides. Now he writes and exposes the agenda of the feminist movement. So this is an insider from that movement who says this, quote, the revolutionary members of the women's movement say that our sexual relationships are fundamental to all other institutions and activities. If one could profoundly change the relationships between the sexes, they contend, one could radically and unrecognizably transform the culture. They're right about that. That's why they're so making such an effort to change the roles of men and women. They either know if they do that, they can change the whole culture, and they can destroy the church's ability to pass godliness on from one generation to the next. So to a very significant degree, the battle for every generation is a battle over the young women of that generation. It's a battle for the hearts of the young women, because they're the ones that have more influence than anybody else. They're the ones that raise the next generation. They have more influence than anybody on the young ones that come up. And Satan knows that, and the feminists know that. And if the enemy can drag the young women out of their God-ordained places of influence, he can affect an entire generation. And not only that, he can do disastrous harm to those young women, which we'll talk about next week when we talk about the feminization of poverty that's resulted from this movement. But God knew all that too, and so he's known from the beginning that the damage that would be done when his roles for men and women were twisted or ignored, and so he is constantly telling us in his word what those roles are. This is not just cultural stuff here. This is crucial. And so in contrast to all this, listen to what God says. Train the younger women to love their husbands and love their children and to be self-controlled and pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, to be subject to their husbands so that no one will malign the word of God. What a beautiful contrast to the disgusting, godless, satanic fountain of sewage coming out of the mouths of the feminists. There aren't very many verses in the Bible that are going to irritate our culture more than Titus 2, 4, and 5, which is why you're not going to hear this preached very often around here in this area. An area that kind of capitulates to what the world thinks. Our world hates this message. We are not going to be voted most popular church to attend in Boulder County, like our friends down the street here, if we're preaching messages like this, that a woman's role is to love her husband, love her children, and to be busy at the home and to be submissive to her husband. That is offensive to our world. But if you understand the satanic roots of the effort to overturn these roles, and you see the massive damage that's done when they're twisted around, these words become beautiful and precious. People say Paul was anti-women, God is, the scripture is anti-women. It's amazing. Wherever Paul's teaching has gone, women have been elevated. Wherever Jesus' teaching has gone, womanhood has been elevated and women have been honored. And you compare that, the treatment of women in cultures that have been founded on Christian heritage, and contrast that with places where there hasn't been a biblical influence like China with their foot binding, or the Muslim world with their indescribable mistreatment of women. The fact is, nothing honors a woman more than her God-ordained role, God's standard for women. We all have our own ideas of what brings honor and what brings importance and meaning, but none of that means anything in the real world of eternal things. The only way to achieve true significance and fulfillment is to fulfill the purpose your Creator created you for. That's what's going to elevate you to a glorious, lofty position. And that's the only thing. So, I hope that gives you a taste for the importance of this. Now let's take a look at specifics here. Here's what we're to teach the older women, or to teach the younger women. First of all, teach them to love their husbands. Teach them to love their husbands. Now ladies, if you want to have a huge, widespread ministry that the women of our culture will come and flock to come hear you speak, just proclaim a message about freedom. Proclaim, tell the women they're free. Tell them they are released from the shackles of their home responsibilities. Tell them they are loosed from the constraints of family. Tell them that they're out from under the duty of their husbands and children, and they can go out in the world and have fun, and you will be popular. That is the message that's selling. You write a book with that, you'll make big bucks. On the other hand, if you want to keep your speaking schedule nice and light and open, proclaim this message. Remind women of their domestic responsibilities, and you're not going to get people bugging you about speaking at their next retreat very much. Because this is not a message our world wants to hear in our culture. When women come to me for marriage counseling, it's amazing. 9 times out of 10, they'll come wanting help with coping with the things their husband does that bothers them. People come to you for counseling, you're going to find this. They'll come wanting to know, how do I cope with my husband, or how do I change my husband, how to ignore my husband, how to get my husband to love me. It's a pretty rare thing for a woman to come and say, teach me how to love my husband. This is not a question a lot of women are even asking. They're big on teach me how to get him to love me, but not much teach me how to love him. Most of the time, step one in training the young women is just bringing them to a point of realizing this is what they need to be seeking. Before you can teach them to love their husbands, you got to teach them to know that that's what they're supposed to be being taught. It's easy for a woman to deceive herself. Sometimes she can disguise her complaints about her husband in terms that make it sound like she's seeking to learn love, when really she just wants a forum to complain. She'll say something like, you know, how do I love a man? Tell me, how do I love a man who does this? And then she's off to the races with her complaints about her marital situation. You have to start teaching those women what a pleasing thing it is to God for her to love her husband, so she begins to desire that. It's not going to be a popular message, but it's God's message for young women. If you're married, work hard at loving your husband. Learn how to do it. Speak to him with respect and honor. Speak about him with respect and honor. Supply the support and encouragement and motivation that he needs. Love him when he's insensitive. Love him when he's unkind. Love him when he's lazy. Love him when he's gone too much. Love him when he's not gone enough. Express your love to him when he leaves the house in the morning. Express your love to him when he comes in at night. You know, depending, as somebody pointed out to me, depending on your job, there might be women at his work who are very impressed with him. There might be women there standing in line to praise him for the things he's doing. Make sure he knows who his greatest fan is. Don't just love him with natural human love. Be a woman who has learned the art and the virtue of husband loving. Be an expert in this so you can teach it to other women. And it really is something that needs to be taught. And that's what I want you to notice here. Women need to be taught to love their husbands, just like husbands need to be taught how to love their wives. There are a lot of aspects of love that come naturally when you're married, obviously. Those are not what this is talking about. Clearly, they're not what this is talking about, or it wouldn't need to be taught. This is beyond the natural. It's beyond the kind of love that comes intuitively. It refers to those aspects of love that a young woman will tend to be at a loss to figure out on her own. How do I respond to my husband when he does this or says this? Those kind of questions require a mature, godly woman to give a biblical response. There are some things that can only be learned either through a long period of trial and error, mostly error, or learning it from the counsel of a woman who's already gone through that process. So teach them the principle, for example, of subject love rather than object love. Remember, we've talked about that. Subject love, object love is when you look at the object and you say, well, that object is worthy, I'll love that. That's a beautiful thing, I'll love that. That object is not very lovable, I won't love that. And it's dependent on the loveliness of the object. Subject love is the kind of love God has, where it comes from you, the subject. And it's just part of your nature to love. And all someone has to do to receive that love is be there in the room. It just comes out of you, and it's not dependent on the object. Teach them that principle. Teach them the principle of loving their husbands as an outgrowth of their love and honor for Christ. So that you don't love him based on who he is, you love him based on who Christ is. And that's what really enables a woman to love. Many women can only conceive of love in the ways that they desire to be loved. Teach them the principle of loving a man in a way that he will receive as love. What he needs. While you crave romance and affection, he's longing for different things like honor and respect. Teach the women to love in that way. Maybe if you want to teach a younger woman to love her husband, maybe the thing to do is just do a study in the Bible on love. You know, get the series on 1 Corinthians 13 or Colossians 3, that series, How to Be More Loving, and just learn the principles of Scripture on how to be more loving, and then apply those to loving your husband in a way that only a woman knows how to do. So teach them to love their husbands. Let's look at the next one. Teach them to love their children. Again, you might read that and think, why do I need training on that? I mean, that's just natural. What could be more natural than loving your children? It is natural. The love that a woman has for her children naturally is probably the deepest, strongest, most profound kind of love in human existence, right? That's the greatest love there is. Even the most unloving woman, when she has children, will tend to have a deep affection for them. That's not what Paul is talking about. Again, the fact that he says this needs to be taught shows us this has to be some kind of love that goes beyond that natural love. He's talking about love that has to be learned, a God-like love that doesn't come naturally, even for your children. It's beyond the natural kind of love even for your children. So teach them that. Teach them some things they're not going to know on their own. I'll give you a couple examples. First of all, you love your children by loving their dad. You notice loving their husbands comes first before loving the children. And the two are combined. These come in pairs. There are a lot of women who think they're loving their children, but they don't love their husbands. Those women are kidding themselves. If your kids need anything, they need to see you loving your husband. And if you don't love your husband, you're not only failing to love your children, you're harming them. Another example is discipline. The most loving thing you can do for a child is to drive the folly from his heart with firm, consistent discipline. And that doesn't come naturally. Most young parents tend to be way too far over on the side of permissive parenting because that's where your natural instincts push you. That's where your natural human reasoning is going to push you. It takes training from an older, godly woman to learn to love the children in the area of discipline because it's hard. It goes against the grain of the way you feel. Many women think, for example, and have been taught that it's unloving to discipline their children while you're angry, to discipline your kids while you're angry. That's sad, because then the poor kid, he never knows when he's going to get disciplined. If his mom's mad, he doesn't get it. If she's in a good mood, then he gets it, and he never knows when he's going to get it. That's the kind of inconsistency in discipline that'll exasperate a child. That's tough for a kid. Never know when it's going to happen. That's wrong. You need to be consistent in your discipline. It doesn't matter how you feel. The Bible doesn't say anything about your emotions when it talks about discipline. If you've got sinful emotions, deal with your sinful emotions, but don't compound your sin by committing another sin by failing to discipline your child when he needs it, by failing to shepherd his heart and protect him from sin when he needs that protection. There are many women who think they love their teenagers best by being a good friend instead of a parent. They're so desperate for love from their children that they're afraid to forbid their girls to do anything. To forbid them to dress suggestively or to go out with unbelievers or something like that. Some parents are afraid to make their kids come to church for fear that they're going to turn them off. I don't understand that. I got to tell you, when I was growing up, You might be interested to know, I did not like church one bit. I didn't. I did not like going to church. But there was never, ever, ever any discussion in our house about whether we would go to church or Sunday school. For us, it's just one event. You just went there every Sunday. That's it. That was it. Sometimes we discussed whether I would go to school. I'm tired. I don't feel good. Do I have to go to school today? That'd be some kind of discussion. But never church. It was no discussion. We just went. And I didn't like it. And you know, that didn't turn me off to church at all. It didn't turn me off to church. I learned to love church. I watched my parents' example and learned to love it. What it did do for me, though, it made it easy for me to have, when I was in college, to be disciplined and faithful about attending church. You know, there's a lot of college students, a lot of my friends around me who wanted to be disciplined and going to church, but they couldn't manage to discipline themselves because that hadn't been instilled in them. It had always been some kind of an optional thing that maybe you go, maybe you don't. And when you're in college and you're up late and you get tired, there's a lot of mornings where, well, I guess this will be one I don't. But for me, it was just such an ingrained routine that it became very easy for me to discipline myself. You're doing your kids a favor if you instill habits like that. Your kids, I mean, think of, you do it with other things. You do it with natural things. Your kids might not enjoy brushing their teeth or taking a shower, but you don't make that optional for them when they're little kids for fear that you're going to turn them off and embitter them against toothbrushing, right? For the rest of their lives? No, you just ingrain the habit into them so they'll do it the rest of their lives regardless of whether they enjoy it. Now, don't misunderstand. It's also very important, in fact, much, much more important that you teach your kids to desire the things of God, to actually desire them. You know, don't just teach them the routine of spiritual disciplines without also shepherding their heart. But on the other hand, if you are teaching them to love God, you're also, that's a good thing, but you're also doing them a huge favor in the years to come if you, while you're in charge of their daily routine, and weekly routine, you ingrain in them the habit of the spiritual disciplines. You're doing them a big favor because that's your role when they're little, is to be in charge of that. Don't be afraid of your kids. Teach the young women not to be afraid of their kids, but to love them. These are the kinds of things that have to be taught to young women because they don't come naturally. Natural love is very often overpowered by the flesh, right? When love should say no, laziness sometimes wants to say yes or say nothing at all. When love should say yes, selfishness sometimes wants to say no. And you have to teach a woman how to discern between those things. Teach her how to conquer her flesh so that she can love her children. You're willing to die for your child, that's great, but are you willing to take 5 minutes away from your TV show to correct him when he needs you? You'd give your life for your child, but will you give him 10 minutes a day of instruction? You'll practically mortgage your house so that he can be successful in sports, you know, or music. What are you willing to give up for him to be successful spiritually in his walk with the Lord? The natural love a woman has for her children is very powerful, but there's a whole other level to love that's completely unnatural and has to be taught. So teach the younger women the same principles that we covered for loving her husband. Teach her those principles and show her how to apply those to loving children. Teach her to love her children when they're unlovely. You know, a kid can go from being real cute to real ugly real fast, right? You all know, those of your parents know that. And it's very common for a young mother to have feelings of resentment towards her children intermingled simultaneously with feelings of love, isn't it? And that produces a lot of guilt and confusion and all kinds of problems. And then women sometimes won't discipline their kids because they feel guilty about their feelings of resentment. All kinds of problems, things that need to be taught. When there's selfishness in your heart, which there always is to one degree or another, you will begin to resent anyone who makes your life hard, right? When you're selfish, you're going to resent anybody that makes your life hard. And that's what young children do. Make your life hard. And so you need to teach young women selflessness, the concept of giving up your life for another, That's a principle we understand, right? I mean, you understand the nobility of that. You die in someone else's place. I mean, you push someone out of the way of a speeding car and you get hit and give up your life to save someone else. That's a noble thing. Everyone recognizes that. Teach the young women to see that that's what they're doing when they raise their children. They're giving up their life for another. You're taking years of your life when you could be relaxing. You could be using that money for a whole lot of fun things. You could be doing all kinds of great things. And you're sacrificing your life for another. That is the highest love there is. Teach them that. Teach her to be selfless. Teach her the principle of forgiveness, instant forgiveness. You know, there's a couple of different levels of forgiveness. There's one level that's just instantaneous, where somebody does something that hurts you, they don't or won't ask for forgiveness, but there's a degree to which you overlook that sin. That's something a mother of young children really needs to learn, because those little ones aren't capable of even knowing what they're doing. They don't even know they're creating such an inconvenience for you. I mean, he doesn't even realize. He's waking up in the middle of the night screaming with night terrors, and it's not his fault. It's just happening to him because he's a little kid. Or he wets his bed, and you got a mess, and you have to deal with that. And it's not his fault. He doesn't mean anything wrong to do, any evil coming out of his heart. And yet there's a degree to which you need to forgive him because he's making your life difficult. Teach him how to forgive like that. So teach them to love their husbands. Teach them to love their children. Next, teach them to be self-controlled. Sophronos. Here we go again with that root. Remember that one? It means to be in control of your emotions and your impulses. Teach them that. God has blessed women with superior abilities in the area of emotions. They have a greater capacity to be like God in that they are in that way because the way they experience emotions, since God is the most emotional being in existence. But the downside of that gift is the fact that unless they learn to be disciplined in their thought life, that their decisions are going to be driven by emotion rather than reason, which is a bad thing. A young woman needs an older woman to come alongside her and teach her how to think clearly and rationally, even in the midst of an emotional crisis. Women don't naturally know how to do that. Many women don't even try. They figure that since God made me an emotional being, I have the right to indulge any emotion I want and postpone logic and reason until the emotion dies away. Older women who have gained mastery over their flesh and thoughts need to teach that to the younger women. For some women, the idea of acting in opposition to the way they feel is completely foreign. But that's exactly what they need to learn. They need an older woman to teach them how to be feeling one way and then decide to act another way. The temptation for women is to feel an emotion and allow that feeling full access into their thought life. She gets mad, and the temptation is to turn the keys of her brain over to that feeling so her thoughts just run wild about whatever it is that's making her mad. She gets scared, and she turns the keys of her thought life over to that feeling of fear so that her thoughts just run unbridled about the object of her fear. She feels a desire for something, and she just allows that desire to take over the cockpit of her mind, and for minutes at a time, she's dwelling on and coveting that thing. She needs to be taught how to discipline her thought life and to keep in control of her mind at all times. She needs someone to teach her how to gain the strength it takes to say, yes, I feel this way, but no, those thoughts are not going to infest my heart. And they just get booted right back out the moment they come in, just like a man who's struggling with thoughts of lust or something, just needs to push them out right away. One temptation many women face in the thought life is the temptation to just retreat into a world of fantasy, just a fantasy world. And it's not that they're focused necessarily on anything obscene or overtly sinful or anything like that. It's just a fictional world where they don't have to deal with reality, and they just want to retreat into a non-real world instead of thinking about the things that God would have them think about. Philippians 4 gives us the list of things that we're supposed to be thinking about, and what's number one in the list? Whatsoever is true. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy, think on those things. Teach them to think on those things. Okay, and then quickly, and teach them to be pure. That's the companion virtue with Sophronos. Teach the young women how to keep themselves from spiritual contamination. Satan would soil the hearts of the women just as much as he wants to soil men's hearts. He just uses different means. With men, the temptations tend to be more crass, more blatantly, obviously sinful. For women, it comes in much more subtle forms. And as I said, this goes with the word self-controlled. When a young woman is not self-controlled and doesn't have command over her impulses, she will be driven by her emotions, which will grow out of control, and that will lead her into impurity. That's what Satan will do with it. Very often, it's a desire for affection for a lot of women, especially single women. Young women who do not place restraints on their desire for affection will turn that into an idol, and it becomes obvious what the object of their worship is. They want affection more than anything, and they will do anything to get it. They'll go all the way through junior high and high school and college without ever going more than 2 weeks without a boyfriend. They'll become so dependent, completely dependent on affection, that they can't even function in life unless they got some kind of a dating relationship going. And the result of that is always, eventually, impurity at some point. You get that desperate for affection, Satan knows how to use that, and he'll find out a way to take away your purity. You will eventually give whatever it takes to get that affection, even if it means giving up your purity. But it doesn't have to be that. It can be anything. For married women, sometimes it's the desire for romance that can lead you into impurity. Pornography for women is very different than pornography for men. It comes in the form of apparently clean movies and clean TV shows that depict adulterous relationships in a glorified romantic setting. It seems perfectly clean, but it takes adultery and makes it look good. That's what the soap operas do. Satan knows if he can attract your attention to fantasies of romance, the more he can get you to do that, the more he can get you to nurture thoughts of discontent about your husband, which is always the starting point of adultery. That's what adultery is. You nurture thoughts of discontent for your spouse, which is the opposite of love, which covers over weakness. And that's tricky because those kinds of temptations don't seem as evil. So for some reason, in some ways, it's easier for men because you can see how evil the temptations for men are. For women, it's harder. The kinds of movies that are going to tempt a man are rated R, you know, or X. And to watch those, he's going to have to sneak off somewhere by himself to watch them. But the kind of movies that would very often tempt a woman with images of a romantic encounter with Mr. Wonderful may very well be rated PG, and she can sit around with a group of women from the church and watch it. Or sit there with her husband and watch it, and nobody has any idea that that movie is pulling her heart into sin. Another area of impurity for women is the area of desiring to be an object of lust. That's another one that sometimes will be a temptation for women. To be an object of lust. You ever notice that when they market a magazine to men, they do it by putting a partially clothed woman on the cover? Very partially clothed. And when they market a magazine to women, what do they put on the cover? Same thing. A partially clothed woman. Why do they do that? It's not because the women are attracted to or would lust after that woman on the cover like the men do. What it is, it's an attempt to get you as a woman to want to be like that woman on the cover. Satan is constantly taking immodesty and immorality and putting it in front of your face and saying, that's beauty. That's what you want to be like. That's what a desirable woman is. Real pleasure comes from being desired like this. That kind of thinking can have a great influence on a woman, even a godly woman at varying levels. I mean, some women, I mean, if you're a mature godly woman, you see some of that stuff in some of those magazines, and you're not going to be tempted by that. You realize she's just a prostitute, basically. That's all those women are, who pose for that kind of stuff. And you're not tempted to dress like that and walk around town almost completely exposed. But since women don't naturally understand how the male mind works, they don't understand what's in a man's mind, a very clear distinction between pretty and erotic. The women can't distinguish between those. Doesn't know how the male mind distinguishes between those. And so what happens is very often there are women who are godly and would be horrified at the thought of being immodest in any way and yet are nonetheless immodest in the way they dress. And they might come to church dressed in a way that makes it very difficult for a man to look her in the eye because the attention is being drawn to her body because of the way that she's dressed, and they don't even realize it. You know, there are dresses that fit snugly on a woman that seem to the women to be very modest, but they draw attention to your body and it makes it tough for the men. Many women wear skirts that are, you know, above the knees, and they seem plenty modest. And in some cases, The women don't know that because their husband maybe isn't affected by seeing a woman's legs like other men are. And so even he thinks it's modest. And so she comes to church and makes it very difficult. She has no idea she's creating a huge struggle for a number of the men. Or sometimes women will wear see-through clothes or something that's unbuttoned. And then they've got something on underneath. So they're completely covered up. To them, it seems perfectly modest. They don't understand that for a man, just the fact that you're wearing something that's see-through is all it takes to get the imagination going. And you're making it hard. Women dressed that way get attention from men. They get looked at, and they interpret that as being attractive. In fact, sometimes even other women will come to them and say, other women who have been affected by the same culture, who also think that's what the measure of attractiveness is, will say, oh, you look great, you look cute, that's very pretty. And they don't realize that they're getting looks from men and being attractive to men are two completely different things. They don't understand that. They don't understand what makes men stumble. This is all stuff that needs to be taught to the younger women. If you're inadvertently the cause of somebody's sin, that's a bad thing. If you're intentional about it, that is a very serious sin. Matthew 18:6 says, Jesus said, if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and drown in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of things that cause people to sin. Those things must come, but woe to those through whom they come. If you are intentionally making yourself the object of lust, you are asking for so much judgment, you would be better off dead. That's what Jesus is saying. Quickly, one last one. Adulterous fantasy. Fantasies that begin in a very non-sexual way. Thoughts about how nice it would be to be married to this spiritual leader over here, this guy at church that you saw or something like that, instead of the bum you're stuck with. Your thoughts, you nurture thoughts like that, nurturing thoughts of discontent about your husband, next thing you know, those thoughts go from being just thoughts of discontent to thoughts that are impure. And those are just examples. I'm really kind of stabbing around in the dark at some of this stuff. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. I could preach a message like this for men and talk about impurity, and I'd get the nail right on the head. I know what that's all about. But for women, I don't know what's tempting. To me, it seems like women are just all naturally pure. And it doesn't seem like you're tempted by anything. But I know you have temptations because this text tells us to train the younger women to be pure. So it must be a struggle. And you who are women are the ones that need to teach the other women that. Because you know. I'm just trying to get you some examples to maybe get your thinking started.